plan to do something a little bit different today. Over the last couple weeks, as I was preparing for Deuteronomy 1, what we went through last week, there has been just kind of a message that's working in my mind that technically, though related to what we saw last week in Deuteronomy, is not actually in Deuteronomy. And before I actually tell you what it is, let me really quickly review what we learned last week so that I can show you how it ties into what we're going to do this week. There we go. All right, so first of all, big picture overview of where we have been. We are in the book of Deuteronomy, and we're talking about the words of life, the instruction of God, Yahweh, for covenant relationship. We are learning what it means to have a relationship with God. That is our series. And though maybe for many of us, we don't, the first time we come into Deuteronomy, we don't think of them as the words of life, we're finding that that's actually what this is. This is God's instruction for how to have full and true life with Him. And we have quite a mouthful, and I haven't gone through this in recent weeks, but let me just remind you of what that instruction is. If we have to sum up the instruction of Deuteronomy in about a sentence, we could say it's this. It is choose life. God is instructing us to choose true life. That's why Deuteronomy is the words of life. And in essence, He is saying that we are to embrace existence as God's people, in God's place, with God's blessed presence. Well, how do we do that? Well, we obey what He says in light of what He's promised. That is the message of Deuteronomy in a nutshell. So, last week, I tried to introduce us to what we call the rebellion. Remember, a couple weeks ago, we talked about whenever we hear the word in the place name Kadesh, Kadesh Barnea, we want to associate that in our minds with rebellion. The rebellion of God's people against what He had told them to do. So I really quickly want to review what we saw there. We discussed one way to analyze really any narrative portion. And we talked about the general flow of a narrative portion of Scripture. And we saw that you can see it in five stages. You start with what we call the exposition here. And this is really the background setting. Last week we saw in verse 19, where we see God's people on a journey, where they are overcoming obstacles as they are obeying God, and they are getting to the edge of opportunity, the edge of the promised land at the end of verse 19. That's the exposition. That's the background. And then we talked about what we could call the rising action. And this is where the tension begins to mount, or the excitement and anticipation begins to mount. And in verses 20 to 25 of last week, we found that coming in the fact that the people were going toward the promised land. They were now looking at the promised land, evaluating it, and getting ready to go in. And we are thinking, yes, finally, we're going to see God's promise come to pass. But at the very top of the apex of that mountain, we find the climax of the story. And as I said last week, the climax of last week's story was actually the valley. The high point was the low point. The point at which all the tension is resolved, in one sense, is actually it's being resolved in a negative fashion. Because what we find is as they come to the very edge of the promised land, they rebel. They say, we will not go up. We do not trust that God can bring us the victory. And so, the climax of the story, again, is really the low point. So then, the rest of the story, verses 34 to 45, we find the falling action of the story. What happens as a result of that decision? And we found that, in essence, it's God's judgment. God's curse comes upon them, that they are not going to go into God's place and that they are actually going to miss God's presence. God says He's no longer with them. And so the very end, what we called the resolution, is where the people are unsettled. They're not in their home, so to speak. And so this was the main idea that we tried to spend most of the lesson talking about last time. We found that idea of going up was mentioned so often. Are they going to go up in obedience or are they not? And we learned this, that going up in pride is the quickest way to go down in defeat. Anytime that we begin to look at ourselves as the ones that have to have all the resources to be able to do what we're supposed to do in our lives, we can know that we're preparing for a fall. Going up in pride is the quickest way to go down in defeat. So I just want to remind you of a couple ways that we saw that we express pride. How do we express pride? Well, not doing what God says to do, first of all. And there are a number of ways. I'm not going to go through these, and you can't read them anyway. So not doing what God says to do is one of the ways in which we express pride, saying, God, no, you've said this, but I think this. And the flip side of that is doing what God says not to do. God, you've told me not to do this, but I believe I can for whatever reason. This is a very obvious way of expressing pride, and when we do so, we should be expecting defeat. So if we're going to flee this failure, there were three ideas that Moses brought up that I really encouraged us with last week. Number one, when facing opportunity or facing situations like that, don't let your emotions control you. Recognize that your delivering God is the same that he's always been. And so remember his past work. And then remember that the fact that he's acting on your behalf is because he loves you. He has a relationship with you. So again, all of this is review, but I want to say this. We finish by saying now it's time to face the future that God has for us. And as I had been thinking on this for the last few weeks, there, as I said, there was a message that was developing in my mind, tied to this, but different from it. And that's where what I really want to introduce you to today. We finished by saying, when going up to face the future, be sure to do so in faith and not fear. And as I talked about that, as I thought about that, I thought, I think it would be helpful for us to take one more message to say, how do we do that? How do we practically do this when we go up to face an unknown future, but a future that God has told us to go into with confidence? How do we do that in faith and not fear? And so today, that's really what I want to do. I want to follow up with this question. How then, based on everything we saw last week, do we face the future in faith? And I'm going to put this in, and I put this in parentheses, especially when we're called to face giants. Why do I say that? Well, if you remember, in Deuteronomy 1, one of the things that came up is that these people are a lot taller than them. And they even say that the Anakim are part of those that are in the land. And the Anakim, you could do a Bible study. If you just search Anakim in the Bible, you will find that these are the quintessential giants. These are those that are overpowering. They're the giants that Caleb would be called to face and that the people would be called to face. So I want to ask this question today, following up from last week. How do we face the future in faith when we are called to face giants? And obviously, I'm not talking about, you know, you going out and fighting a physical person. I'm talking about the way Paul does, where we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but I'm talking about the spiritual giants, the giant situations that we are called to face. How do we do that? So, as I told you, this was working in my mind. I wanted to take two men in the Bible who God called to face giants and see what we can learn from their lives, what we can learn from their faith, what we can learn from their actions, and I want to bring their stories together and distill some important truths for us. So, who are those men? Well, the first is Caleb, and this is why it definitely does at least connect to our story. Though I'm going to ask you to turn to Numbers 13 right now. This is the story that we have recounted for us in Deuteronomy 1, so it's still appropriate. And then obviously the other is David with Goliath. And so I want us to take a look at these stories, Numbers 13 and 14, and then there's another part of it in Joshua, and then 1 Samuel 17. Now, before I read the stories for you, I want to go ahead and at the outset, I want to give you the principles that I believe that we learn from their lives. So I'm going to give them to you, and then I'm going to try to show you how each of these stories illustrate this point. So here you go. Four principles today for facing giants. Four principles for facing giants. First of all, don't distort the facts. Now, it's going to make sense when we go through this, but don't distort the facts. Look them square in the eye. That's the first thing. Secondly, don't deny the faith. Remember who fights for you. Don't distort the facts. Don't deny the faith because you need to remember who fights for you. Third, don't delay obedience. Take the first step of faith now. And then finally, don't diminish God's glory. Publicly proclaim his work. So this is what we're going to see. Similarities between these two men in the times in which they are called to face giants. Now Caleb's is actually going to come in two steps. And then David is going to come all in 1 Samuel 17. So, should be in Numbers chapter 13 right now. So what I want to do, I want to read to you Numbers 13, 25 through chapter 14 and verse 10. So this is a number of verses, and I'm going to try to read it all at once. Try not to fall asleep in the next 2 minutes as I read through it. But I am going to highlight a few things, but I want you to see the whole story first of all. So here we go. Numbers 13, verse 25. When they return. So this is talking about those 12 spies that go into the land to spy out the land. When they return from spying out the land, at the end of 40 days, they... excuse me. My voice is better than last week, but I have a little lingering cough. They proceeded to come to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation of the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. And they brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Then they told him and said, "We went into the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Amalek is living in the land of the Negev, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites are living in the hill country. And the Canaanites are living by the sea and by the land by the side of the Jordan." Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "We should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we will surely overcome it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us." So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they'd spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. There we also saw the Nephilim. The sons of Anak are part of the Nephilim. And we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so were we in their sight." So then verse chapter 14. "Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. All the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The whole congregation said to them, 'Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?' So they said to one another, 'Let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt.' Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces in the presence of all the assembly of the congregation of the sons of Israel. Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, of those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. And they spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, 'The land which we pass through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord is pleased with us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord and do not fear the people of the land, for they will be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them.' But all the congregation said to stone them with stones. Then the glory of the Lord appeared in the tent of meeting to all the sons of Israel." So, you see here, on this slide, I have put various references from what we just read to show these points. So I just want to walk you through these. I'm going to do this with Caleb, and then I'm going to do this with David, and then we're going to talk about the application of all this. So first of all, I want you to look at Numbers 14 and verse 9 on this idea of don't distort the facts. Do not fear the people of the land, for they will be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them. Now I want you to look back at verses 31 and 33 through 33 of the previous chapter. This is where the men who went up with Caleb talk about the land, that they're the people of the land, that they're large, that they have cities. I just want to point this out. When Caleb is talking to the people, does he say this? Oh, no, 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 don't listen to those guys. I was there. There actually aren't giants. There really aren't fortified cities. You don't have to worry those things because these guys are just lying. Is that what he said? No. He didn't change the facts to try to give himself confidence that we can do this. He looked the facts square in the eye and said, what does he say in 14 and verse 9? Do not fear them. They will be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them. Why? Because God is with us. It's not that he put himself up over them. It was that he put them down in light of the next fact. Don't deny the faith. Remember who fights for you. Because he says in verse 9, the very next thing he says is that the Lord is with us. It doesn't matter how big they are. It doesn't matter how strong their cities are. It doesn't matter how much taller they are, because God is with us. And so their protection, based on his promise, has been removed from them. Same thing in verse 30. He quiets the people before Moses and he says, we should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we will surely overcome it. How can Caleb say that with such confidence? Well, God has promised it for hundreds of years. God has promised this for hundreds of years. He is with them. And so, number one, don't distort the facts. When facing giants in your life, don't try to go at it in this, in trying to diminish the magnitude of the circumstance. God does not tell us that he's never sending us up against, he's only sending us against small problems that we can handle in ourselves. God does send us up against situations that are so magnified and huge so that we could call them giants. Don't distort that. What you do instead is you don't deny the faith. You remember who's fighting for you. You remember what God has said about that situation. And then, number three, don't delay obedience. Take the first step of faith now. Watch how Caleb responds. Look at verse 30. Caleb quiets the people before Moses in chapter 13 and said, we should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we will surely overcome it. Does he say, hey, let's take a while, let's make a few committees, and let's determine how much bigger they are, let's run our analytics and see, in how everything goes, if in this, we've got March Madness right now, so you've got all the, analytics of who's going to win. All right, so is that what he's saying? Let's see what our chances are. Let's take some time, let's figure out. No, he says, let's go. Let's go up and take it. Let's not delay obedience. God's promised this, and let's go forward. Same thing in chapter 14, verses 6 and 7. Joshua and Caleb, they tore their clothes, and they said, the land that we passed through to spy out is an exceeding good land. They are saying, we need to move forward. We are so broken over what is happening here with people saying, let's go back. Let's turn away. They're saying, let's go forward right now. Finally, don't diminish God's glory. Publicly proclaim his work. This happens at this point in verse 8, where they say, if the Lord is pleased with us, he will bring us into this land and will give it to us. And then again in verse 9, the Lord is with us. They are testifying to the fact that God is so great. He is the one that's going to do this. They are not diminishing his glory at all. I want to show you the second part of this story. I want you to turn now to Joshua 14 and 15. We're going to go about 40, 45 years later here. And we're going to see the end of this story. Because as you know, unfortunately, there is this all these years in wandering. And ultimately, Caleb and Joshua are the only ones from that generation who go into the land. But we find Caleb again in Joshua chapter 14. And I want to show you that he's still the same guy that he was that generation earlier. He's going to be doing the exact same thing. And I'll put these references up here for you. This is part two of his life. Now if you go to Joshua, I'm not going to read all of these verses. I'm just going to highlight a few of them. Look at verses 10 to 12 of chapter 14 in Joshua. Now behold, the Lord, this is Caleb speaking, has let me live just as he spoke these 45 years from the time that the Lord spoke this word to Moses when Israel walked in the wilderness. And now behold, I am 85 years old today. I am still as strong today as I was in the day that Moses sent me. As my strength was then, so my strength is now for war and for going out and coming in. Now then, give me this hill country about which the Lord spoke on that day. For you heard on that day that the Anakim were there with great fortified cities. Perhaps the Lord will be with me and I will drive them out as the Lord has spoken. He's now 85 years old, 45 years after. The Anakim were there. The cities are still there. And he's saying, let me at them. He's not distorting the facts. He's not saying, hey, I'm so glad we waited these 45 years. The Anakim are all gone and all those walls fell down. This is great. No. Same situation, 45 years later, he's not distorting it. He's saying, if anything, we would look at it and say, the situation's worse. He's 85 now. And he's saying, let me go forward. I have God's promise. Let's go. Don't deny the faith. What is it that gives him such great confidence? Perhaps the Lord will be with me, and I will drive them out as the Lord has spoken. He is remembering God's presence again. I want to show you, for don't delay obedience, look at chapter 15, verses 13 and 14. Watch what happens. We didn't get this back in Numbers. But in verses 13 and 14 in the next chapter, we find that Caleb does the very thing that he wanted to do 45 years earlier. He doesn't delay obedience. Now he, talking about Joshua, gave to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, a portion among the sons of Judah, according to the command of the Lord to Joshua, namely, Kiriath Arba, Arba being the father of Anak, that is Hebron. Caleb drove out from there the three sons of Anak, Sheshai, Haiman, Talmai, the children of Anak. He doesn't delay obedience, and he does the very thing that he said would be possible. He took the three sons of Anak, drove them all out. God is with him. He takes that step of obedience and sees God's working. And then, again, I just want to point out, with not diminishing God's glory, look at verse 10 again of chapter 14. When Caleb talks about what has happened, he always talks about the Lord. Look at verse 10. The Lord has let me live, just as he spoke these 45 years. Just as he spoke the time that the Lord spoke this word to Moses. God has been with me. God has done this. He is testifying to God's presence in his life. All right. I want to go look at David quickly, and then I want to summarize these truths. So let's turn to 1 Samuel chapter 17. Again, I'm not going to read this whole chapter. I just want to dip into a few places to show that these ideas that we saw with Caleb are also true with David. So 1 Samuel chapter 17. Again, don't distort the facts, don't deny the faith, don't delay obedience, and don't diminish God's glory. There are a number of things I want to say here at the end, so I'm going to go pretty quickly through David. You're pretty familiar with David, so I'm not going to take too long here. But I think it's interesting, if you look at 1 Samuel 17, verses 4 to 11, I'm not going to read these, but just let your eyes skim down through that. This is where it is talking about who Goliath is, his armor, how tall he is, what he's doing every day. You know, am I not a Philistine and you the servants of Saul, taunting how big and how powerful the bravado that is shown by this man. But now what I want to show you is if you go in 1 Samuel 17, verses 31 to 35, look at David's response. Is it that David comes in saying, like, this guy's not tall. I've heard this guy's tall. He's not tall. He doesn't have armor. You know, is that David's response? No, look at this, verse 31. When the words which David spoke were heard, they told him to Saul, and Saul sent for him. David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail on account of him. Your servant will go and fight this Philistine. Then Saul said to David, you're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him. You're but a youth, and he's been a warrior from his youth. Now, does David say, no, those things aren't true? He's not a warrior. What are you talking about? But David said to Saul, your servant was tending the father's sheep, my father's sheep, when a lion or a bear came and took the lamb for the flock. I went out after him, attacked him, and rescued him from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him. So here's what is in essence happening. This man is a big problem. But David says, I've had big problems before. I've seen big problems before. And as we're going to see, it's not just that I'm the one that beat the lion and the bear. We're going to see that David's confidence in being able to face big problems comes from his confidence in the Lord. That's what I want to show you next. Don't deny the faith. Remember who fights for you. Look at the very next verses, verse 36. So David has just said, all right, yeah, this guy's a problem, but I've faced big problems before. Well, David, what gives you so much confidence? Verse 36, your servant has killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God. And David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from this Philistine. So he's not distorting the facts. This guy's a big problem, just like lions and bears are big problems. But there is a God who delivered David from lions and bears, and there is a God who can deliver David from giants. And so, what's the response? Well, look at the very, let's just keep reading. Second half of verse 37. Same thing we found with Caleb. Don't delay obedience. So what happens? Saul said to David, go and may the Lord be with you. Then Saul clothed David with his garments and put a bronze helmet on his head, clothed him with armor. David girded his sword over his armor and tried to walk, for he had not tested them. So David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them. David took them off. He took a stick from his hand, chose for himself five smooth stones from the brook, put them in the shepherd's bag that he had, even in his pouch and his sling in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. He just moves forward. He says, God's with me, so let's take this step now. I'm moving forward. And then finally, skip down to verse 45. Don't diminish God's glory. Publicly proclaim his worth. Then David said to the Philistine, you come to me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come to you again in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. And then in verse 47, he says this, or at the end of verse 46, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. So again, don't diminish God's glory. Show that this is not just that you're somebody special. You're something powerful. You are the hero. So what I want to do now, I hope that at least with these two instances, we've at least seen these general principles. But now what I really want to do is I want to try to apply this to, if I could say it like this, the giant situations that God causes us to face. Now, I don't want to, you know, we could see this as potentially, you know, we want to be careful about spiritualizing things. And yet at the same time, we see that though Caleb's situation was different than David's, there are similarities there. And we also know that in many ways, as we've seen in recent weeks, that the way once we get to the New Testament, we see that our wrestling is not primarily or merely against flesh and blood, but against all these spiritual forces and the realities that we're facing day in and day out. So what I want to do is I do want to apply each of these principles to us and to our lives. So I want to look at them individually here. Don't distort the facts. Let's start there. Look them square in the eye. When going into battle spiritually, it can be so easy for us to play with psychology instead of dealing with the task at hand. What do I mean by that? Well, if you just go out into the world, you can read many psychology books, self-help books, that tell you that in essence, you know, just tell yourself that you can do this. Now, boiling it all down, you can do this. Pump yourself up. Go for it. You're so good. These ideas that we just have to preach these things to ourselves, right? Or, you know, the flip of that is just, you know, tell that problem how small it is. Just talk about how small that problem is in face of what you're going to do to it. But I just want to say, you know, that is actually not the biblical way. We see that these men and that in general in Scripture, we're not told to just deny the reality of the difficulty of situations. We don't come up and say that this is so easy. I think, again, even another example, the Lord in the garden. is praying, it's not as though he looks at, if we could say it like this, the problem at hand and just says it's nothing. No, he goes into it with full knowledge of how big it is, and yet with the confidence that this is what his Father has called him to do, and that this is what is this is the path to redemption. So instead of just playing mind games or using self-talk to promote our own confidence, we must look the facts square in the eye. Another way of saying this is facing our fears. Very often, when these giant situations come up, if you're anything like me, I get so overwhelmed in emotion that it's so easy to, just like Israel, give up before we've even done anything. But we have to say this. We cannot run from the reality of how difficult the situation is. In a sense, we have to relish it. Now, why? Not relish in the sense of an enjoyment of pain. But I'm saying relish may not be the right word, but we have to recognize it. Maybe that's better. Because we have to know that how big the problem is actually only an opportunity to show how great our God is. And for us to take the next step in our spiritual sanctification and development. Now, really quickly, I want to give an important aside. I was talking to somebody about this message this week. It's been working in my mind, and they asked a really good question to me. Are these giant situations objective? Now, here's what I mean. Are there certain situations in our lives that we could say, okay, yeah, that's a giant situation? Whereas other situations, like, no, that's not a giant situation. That's just a common spiritual struggle. But then this is a giant situation. I just want to address that. I've been thinking about that this week, and I think it's an important question to answer, and I think it's a hard one. But here is my answer. My short answer is that I believe that any situation could be a giant situation. And therefore, I think that it's the distinction between is it a giant or is it not is a bit irrelevant, and here's why. There is a real sense in which anything of true spiritual good is impossible for the natural man. Anything of spiritual good is really a giant situation, right? Because think about this. What does Jesus say to his disciples as he's about to leave? John 15. I've been with you for 3 years now. So I just want you to know when I'm gone, you're able to do everything you need. You're totally equipped. Don't worry. No, he says this. Without me, you can do nothing. That's why I'm sending a helper. It's not that, now, he does say that he's equipped them with his word, and with that they are able, with the Spirit dwelling in them, but he doesn't say this. He doesn't say, hey, now that you've been with me for so long, you can handle everything on your own. No, without me, you can do nothing. So there is a real sense in which anything of spiritual good is impossible for you and me. And in that sense, everything that God asks us to do of real spiritual good could be seen as a giant situation. You see, I think we can even see this as we look back on our own spiritual lives. I don't want to deny that at different stages of our spiritual experience and growth, there may be things that we evaluate in a different way than we would have early on in our Christian experience. So think back to this. The moment, think back to the first year you were saved. There were probably some things then that you thought were like absolutely giant situations. And you look back now and you might even kind of chuckle and be like, I ain't seen nothing yet. There was a lot more coming. But if you look back to those times, those were the very situations that taught you to rely on the Lord, that taught you that you were totally unable. And so now, as you have grown, and in essence, you've gone to that spiritual gym and done a few more reps, now you're actually able to see how much you need the Lord. And now you're reminded and you've learned that I need the Lord for everything. So, the fact is not so much that you are a much better person. No, it's that God has much more of you today than he did back then. And so really, it's not that you're much more powerful, but rather that you're so much more confident in a God that is. So to wrap it all up, I just want to say this. Really, any situation, I believe, can be a giant situation based on where we are in our lives and our growth. But the real question is whether or not we have a perspective on who is with us, which is the second idea. Don't deny the faith. Remember who fights for you. So first thing we've got to do is we've got to look at the facts. and actually being true about the facts, staring our fears in the face, so to speak, is the first step in responding appropriately. Because that is going to bring us to our knees and say, I can't do this. And it's got to push us to remember who is with us. So, don't deny the faith. Remember who fights for you. Faith is all about acting based on foundational truth rather than your subjective perspective in the moment. There are many situations in life where at a particular moment, the thing that may seem right is actually the wrong thing to do. One illustration that came to my mind, I went to the FAA website and read more about this, but it's pilots not trusting their instruments in the midst of flying. There are deaths consistently because pilots get in situations where they think they need to go up and they're actually doing the opposite thing. They think they're going up, but they're going down, and in essence, it causes death. We have those type of situations spiritually pretty consistently. We get into a situation in the midst of the emotion, we say, we know what we need to do. But actually, if we follow our heart, so to speak, we're going down when we should be going up. And we can all see that in our lives, different times in which that was the case. And so when I say don't deny the faith, I follow it up with this: remember who fights for you. To fly by your instruments, in the same, you know, pilots are supposed to fly by their instruments, not based on their perception. To fly by the instruments spiritually means that you are making decisions not based on what you're feeling in the moment, but what God says. So, acting in a situation based upon God's direction and His promise. The question for all of us is this: do we know God well enough to do this? Do we know what God thinks? Do we know what God says? Do we know what He has promised? God must be central in our thinking when we face our giants. Caleb and David were clearly calibrated to take God into account. So let me ask you this. When you find yourself in an overwhelming circumstance, do you get so taken by the opposition that you forget about God? I'm not even saying that we never pray about it, but sometimes our prayers are not even prayers of faith. We feel as though this situation is so overwhelming that we think that God might be overwhelmed by it too. But if that's the case, then your God is not the God of the Bible. He is not overwhelmed, He is in control, and He is using this situation for your ultimate good. We must calibrate according to God and His truth, or we will end up destroying ourselves. Third, don't delay obedience. Once we're reminded of God's presence in our lives, and we know the right way that He would want us to respond, our next response is clear. We must step out in faith. You know, just as Caleb didn't set up a committee and say, okay, now we've got to look into our analytics this week and got to see, okay, how good are they versus how good are we? What are our chances here? No, that wasn't it. It's let's go. Let's go. Same thing that we find in Joshua. David, the same way. Hey, I know God has called me to do this, so let me at Him right now. As soon as we remember who is with us, we know how big the problem is, we've submitted to the Lord and His guidance, it's time to take that step. It's time to start in that direction. We know, and probably some of us as parents have said this, to delay is to disobey. To delay is to disobey. If God's called us to do something, I'm not saying it's going to be all over in a moment, but we have to start down the path of obedience. David's path to obedience went, all right, this armor is not good for me, so I'm going to go get my stones. Walk down to the brook, let's go. So take that first step of obedience. And then finally, don't diminish God's glory. Publicly proclaim His work. The final admonition is not to diminish God's work. Here's another thing that's so easy. Let's say we see God bring us through this situation, another giant that He has called us to face. And we get to the end, and how many of us then say, big sigh of relief. I'm so glad we're past that situation. And we move on. We'll take a moment, personally, to recognize God's greatness, and then, as appropriate, share it with those who have seen it. David stands in the middle, and he says, you're going down, not because of me, but so that all these people know that there is a God in Israel. And so we have to be people who are willing to recognize God's work and then to proclaim it to those who are watching. So, I want to sum all of this up by saying this. I can't remember, did I put this on here? No. the main idea that I want you to take away right now, other than, so these four are important, but it's this. When facing giant circumstances in your life, you must put down fleshly first thoughts in exchange for godly second thoughts. Now, what do I mean by that? I'm going to say it again. When facing giant circumstances in your life, you must put down fleshly first thoughts in exchange for godly second thoughts. So, I've tried to even model this in the way that I stated my realities. I think all of us know the reality is whenever we go up against these giant circumstances, the things that we are tempted to do are in that first category. Our first thought, so to speak, are we want to distort the facts, we want to deny the faith, we want to delay obedience, and we diminish God's glory. These are our first thoughts. We always, in our lives, all throughout our lives, are going to have, the Christian life is all about putting down wrong first thoughts in exchange for godly second thoughts. That instead of allowing our emotional, overwhelming thoughts to overwhelm us, we then bring in, we renew our minds according to God's word, and we live our lives according to those second thoughts. So, as you notice through each of these, my main points are negative, and then I follow up with a positive in parentheses. This is our lives. We have negative first thoughts, and we must follow them up with scriptural, godly truth that speaks into the overwhelming circumstances of our lives so that we take those steps of faith, giving God the glory. So, if I wanted to state these points positively, here's what I would say. Number one, face your fears. Secondly, recount God's sufficiency. Third, step out in faith. And then fourth, praise the victor. And that's not you, it's God. So let me just ask you this. What are you fearful of today? Face it straight on. How inadequate do you find yourself to be? Own it. And then start recounting how adequate God is. Third, how paralyzed do you feel yourself to be in the light of this circumstance? To paraphrase the words of Jesus to a lame man, pick up your leg and walk. Just take that step. You say, I can't take this step of faith. Well, in the same way, that lame man, Jesus says to him, take up your bed and walk. He could have said, I can't do that. I'm lame. God's always asking us to do the impossible things for us. So start moving, even though you're personally incapable. And then how unworthy are you of all this? Admit it, and then praise the one who's done all of this through you. So put down your fleshly first thoughts in exchange for godly second thoughts. When we face the giants of our lives, we find that our biggest problems are like grasshoppers before the one who created all things. Our problems are the grasshoppers. So therefore, like Caleb and David before us, we can face our giants too, because nothing is too big for God. Let's pray. Lord, help us in this. We need it. You call us to face these giant circumstances and problems in faith. May we do so, and then praise you for who you are. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.